Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is a particular point of concern that war for the free world seems to be getting a lot hotter at the moment in North Korea, and in particular that the heat may actually be of a thermonuclear character before too long. To discuss that possibility and the implications not just for our interests in the region, including an awful lot of Americans over there in uniform and out, but also for us here at home, I'm delighted to welcome back once again one of the country's premier experts on matters involving nuclear threats and deterrence. He is Dr. Mark Schneider. I've had the privilege of working with him for the better part of 40 years, including for a time when we overlapped in the office of the Secretary of Defense, where he served for many years in senior capacities, really as the corporate memory of the Defense Department on arms control policy, strategic defense issues, and nuclear forces. These days, he is a senior analyst with the National Institute for Public Policy, extraordinarily important organization in Washington, D.C. Mark is also a former member of the Senior Foreign Service of the United States. Welcome back, Mark Schneider. It's great to have you with us, sir.
Oh, thank you very much for the kind introduction.
I'm anxious to get your thoughts on what the North Koreans are up to at the moment. There's a report in the Wall Street Journal today indicating that they may have stolen a march on our intelligence community by acquiring advanced, or at least more reliable and more capable, missiles rocketry from Ukraine. I don't know if you've had a chance to study this particular report, Mark, but I'm interested in your thoughts about how advanced this North Korean threat now is and the likelihood that it's benefited substantially from foreign technology transfers.
It clearly is a very serious threat, and it's growing, and it has benefited from foreign technology transfer. There's clear involvement by the Russians in the North Korean ballistic missile program, that a number of their missiles are derived from Russian designs, Cold War designs. There's a lot of unclassified information available on that subject. China has had a major impact on the North Korean nuclear weapons program, including transfer to Pakistan of the first Chinese nuclear missile warhead, which the Pakistanis, thanks to AQ Khan, then transferred all over the world. So North Korea has had a for 20 years approximately, missile deliverable nuclear weapons, thanks to the Chinese and the Pakistani.
So, Mark Schneider, just on that point, you're saying that they were capable of putting such weapons into systems that could be delivered by ballistic missiles. This is something that I thought the intelligence community had said they only just believed had been obtained, but this has actually been in place now for some time.
Yes. I mean, it was very small in number, perhaps a couple of weapons in the 1990s. This is what the Clinton administration said in an unclassified report. And the only issue after that was whether or not they could miniaturize, or how fast they could miniaturize the designs to be able to be deliverable by an ICBM.
So a very long-range missile, and that national intelligence estimate has apparently now been updated to say it's now at hand.
Several years ago, DIA made an unclassified assessment that they had missile-deliverable nuclear warheads. The Obama administration tried to shoot that down, But now, according to the current press, Washington Post, for example, ran a story saying that basically the entire intelligence community has signed off on that assessment, including the ICBM warhead part of it. The other thing, earlier this year, the South Korean press, citing the South Korean Defense Ministry, said that the North Koreans had enough fissile material for 60 nuclear weapons. Now, if you look at the internals of that story, they're assuming a very large quantity of fissile material, much more than would be reasonably necessary today.
Each of the weapons, you're saying, this is a conservative estimate, and they could stretch it over a substantially larger number of weapons. Mark Schneider, this is all very troubling, needless to say. Of especial concern to me has been the possibility, as our friends Jim Woolsey, the former director of Central Intelligence, and Dr. Peter Vincent Pry have been warning for some time, is the possibility that the North Koreans may envision using other techniques to inflict incalculable damage on the United States with one or more of these nuclear weapons, using a phenomenon you're familiar with, of course, electromagnetic pulse. Would you talk about that danger and how it might manifest itself?
Electromagnetic pulse is a very serious threat because we, in the United States, thanks to liberal environmentalists, we've netted together our power distribution system in a way which creates a gigantic EMP antenna and maximizes the effectiveness of an EMP strike on the United States. And you don't need ultra-sophisticated nuclear weapons to do this, because any nuclear weapon of significant yield detonated at the right altitude will generate an EMP effect that will take out the power grid. You detonated it near or above Philadelphia, you take out everything roughly from New York City to Washington, D.C.
A very serious threat to a country that is critically dependent upon its electric grid. And is there any doubt in your mind, Mark Schneider, that the North Koreans understand that vulnerability and might be willing to exploit it if they could?
I think they're clearly trying to do that. The report of the EMP Commission indicated that a couple or several Russian nuclear weapons scientists were working on an enhanced EMP weapon in North Korea. The Russians have it too. My basic point here is that even if that report was untrue, fairly unsophisticated nuclear weapons can generate enough EMP effects to have devastating effects, both in a theater and against the continental United States.
Now, Mark, let me turn quickly in the remaining time we have. We're almost out of time. There's so much more to talk about, but I did want to ask you, in response to these developments, President Trump has been making some very forceful statements. One that I wanted just to do a sanity check with you on, as a longtime expert in the Pentagon on these matters, was his statement that, quote, the U.S. nuclear deterrent is now far stronger and more powerful than ever. Just so we're clear, is that true today? And if not, could you just very quickly say, what do we need to do to make it strong and powerful to deter this sort of threat from North Korea?
Okay, what President Trump was apparently referring to is a directive he signed on January 27th, which said that he wanted the U.S. to have a modern, robust, flexible, resilient, ready, and appropriately tailored nuclear stockpile. He has put more money in the FY 2017 budget on readiness, and that's probably had some effect on enhancing bomber capabilities. But it will take a long, long time to translate that sentence into actual capabilities. The Obama legacy is literally a disaster in combat readiness in both nuclear and conventional capabilities. The situation in the nuclear weapons production complex is a disaster that has to be resolved, and it has to be resolved within the next 10 years, or we will be in a very, very serious situation.
I would argue we're pretty much in that situation now, but certainly the remedies are long overdue and much needed. Mark Schneider, you've been warning of these very points for so long. I really appreciate your service both to the country during your years in government and that you're rendering now at the National Institute for Public Policy. Come back to us very soon, if you would, with updates. We'll talk with Gordon Chang next about sort of the geostrategic implications of these developments in North Korea and our response to them. That and much more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It is a great pleasure to have with us Gordon Chang, one of the country's preeminent experts about Asia at a time when we are clearly all focusing on it, notably what is happening in North Korea, as we were just discussing with Dr. Mark Schneider. Gordon is, of course, a columnist at the Daily Beast. He contributes to Forbes.com and blogs at WorldAffairsJournal.com, among other outlets. You see him frequently at Fox and Bloomberg and elsewhere. He is truly one of the go-to guys in light of, among other things, his work in two important publications, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and The Coming Collapse of China. Gordon Chang, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Well, I'd like to start with North Korea, Gordon. We've been discussing with Mark the sort of military dimensions of it, the nuclear capabilities and the like. Talk a little bit about it as you see it from a geostrategic vantage point. Where are we and where is this likely to go?
I think that Beijing has been using North Korea to keep the United States and its allies and friends off balance. And we have yet to come to any sort of understanding on that regard. And, you know, I should point to the op-ed in the Wall Street Journal by Secretary of Defense Mattis and Secretary of State Tillerson, where they say they're moving from strategic patience, which is the Obama policy, to strategic accountability. But in that op-ed, they don't hold China accountable. There's no mention of Chinese money laundering for the North Koreans. We don't see any of the assistance to the nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs. We don't see anything about Chinese sanction busting. We are not going to move the ball. We are not going to protect the American people until we really reach some inconvenient truths that China has helped North Korea created this threat. This is not a story about North Korea or China. This is a story about us, Frank.
Gordon Chang is in the house, virtually at least. We're talking about, Gordon, the degree to which we have failed to take action to this point to stop the North Koreans. This brings us, of course, to the sanctions issue. We've relied on them for a long time. The Chinese have, to varying degrees, gone along with the sanctions at the United Nations, including most recently a set that are described as particularly draconian of late. But do they actually follow through? Do they enforce those sanctions? They're putting out the word that they are this particular new tier of them. What's your take on that, Gordon, and what should we expect going forward?
I would hope that Beijing would enforce the seventh set of sanctions on North Korea from the UN, but they haven't enforced the first six. You know, if we take the last set, which was adopted on November 30th of last year, you know, China on February 18th of this year said that it would no longer buy coal from the North Koreans for the remainder of the year in order to comply with those sanctions. The Chinese, after that announcement in February, bought coal from the North Koreans. They bought coal in April, May, and June, and now it appears they're buying coal from the North Koreans through third countries. So we really have to be concerned about the way the Chinese are talking one way in public, but acting in a very different way. And we have yet to hold them account for that. I mean, we always talk about, oh, you know, the Chinese are trying to do this and trying to do that, and we hope that they comply. But, you know, gosh darn it, Frank, you know, we've seen this so much, so often, continually over the course of decades. We're not doing anything about it.
Well, to the point, Gordon, of accountability, One of the things that is going on today, as you know, as we speak, it's still in prospect. As this program airs this evening, it will have happened. But the president is unveiling some new and, we're told, rather tough measures with respect to China's predatory trade practices. This is happening at a moment, whether it's directly connected or not. It certainly is temporally, and I'm sure in the minds of the Chinese, connected to this ongoing question of whether they're going to be cooperative, helpful, take steps that would actually diminish this growing threat to us. Talk a little bit about what you understand is coming from the president in this regard today, Gordon, and what bearing you think it might have on the North Korean issue in general.
Yeah. President Trump is going to sign, we've been told, a memorandum asking the U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer to think about whether we need an investigation on China's intellectual property practices. In other words, an investigation to see whether we need an investigation. Now, I'm unimpressed because essentially we know that the Chinese over the course of decades have been involved in stealing U.S. intellectual property, and they do it in a number of new ways now, and we talk about it all the time, but this administration and previous ones have done very little to stop the Chinese from this obvious theft, which really goes to the core of the U.S. economy, because the U.S. economy is innovation and technology, and we're letting the Chinese take the fruits of it virtually for free. Now, I hope that we will see a new attitude in this administration. They've been signaling this, but they've been signaling it for a long time. On February 4th, which was a Friday, President Trump was going to announce something more significant, which is a Section 301 investigation, which probably would have led to extraordinary remedies against China. But he didn't go forward because on the previous day, officials from the State Department and the UN convinced the White House not to do it in order to obtain China's cooperation on the UN resolutions that were ultimately adopted on the Saturday, the 5th. That was Resolution 2371, which, although it's a step forward, although it's more draconian than the previous sets of UN sanctions, still is ineffective in that it allows North Korea to earn big streams of income to which they use for their weapons programs. So the administration is moving, slouching towards a better trade policy, but it's not moving fast enough. And I think that we've got to be concerned that the rhetoric is far outpacing the actual substance of what the Trump administration is doing on trade, and indeed, for that matter, on North Korea as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of that going on, it seems, at the moment, Gordon. Quickly, one last point on accountability. In that op-ed you referred to in the Wall Street Journal today, featuring the comments of the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense, they say explicitly, we are not seeking regime change in North Korea. Can we realistically, Gordon Chang, change the character of the threat we're facing from the North, growing as it is, without changing the character of the regime that mounts it?
I think it's extremely difficult. You know, we have overwhelming leverage over China that we haven't exercised. China has overwhelming leverage over North Korea, perhaps even to get rid of Kim Jong-un, which would be regime change in a sense. But, you know, we're not seeing steps to do that. And, you know, I can understand why the secretaries of defense and state don't want to say they're in favor of regime change. But really, it's the ultimate answer and the only answer in all probability.
Speaking of regime change, there's a leadership meeting taking place, as you know, Gordon Chang, in a seaside resort called Bidhai in China. Would you talk a little bit about what's going on behind those very secretively closed doors and what may come of it with respect to the future direction of China?
Yeah, every August, or virtually every August, the top leadership of the Communist Party retreats to Beidaha. And this is where they talk about upcoming events. This one is particularly important because it comes just before the Communist Party's 19th Congress, which occurs once every 5 years. Xi Jinping looks to cement his power. This is a time for President Trump to actually put a lot of leverage on China, because it's a sensitive time for Xi Jinping, and we could actually direct derail Xi Jinping's hopes for consolidation if we were to disrupt the relationship. So I hope that our president will see this as an opportunity to move Beijing in much better directions by putting immense pressure on Xi.
We will follow this closely at Beidahai and beyond. Gordon Chang, thank you so much for joining us today. I know it's a busy time for you with all this going on in your portfolio. We appreciate you taking some time to discuss it with us. Come back to us again very soon. Liz Burney of the Zionist Organization of America will talk with us next about McMaster, his future, and us straight ahead.
More with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It's a pleasure to say, joined, I believe, for the first time by Liz Burney. She is an attorney by training. These days, she is the director of special projects for one of my favorite organizations, the Zionist Organization of America. She directs its Long Island and Queens chapter, among those being credited with a most important new report concerning the National Security Advisor to President Trump, H.R. McMaster, and I was anxious to catch up with Liz to talk with her about some of the findings in the Zionist Organization of America's new report that confirms, I have to say, many of the concerns that I have felt about this lieutenant general as well. And Liz, thank you so much for taking a few minutes. I understand you're a little under the weather, but we're grateful to you for mustering out nonetheless to visit about this important new product.
My pleasure to be here.
How can people get your new report about H.R. McMaster?
It's right on the ZOA website. It's zoa.org. I believe it's still on the front page, but if not, just go into the search box.
Okay, well, it deserves to be on the front page for life as far as I'm concerned. Let me ask you a little bit about some of your findings. First part of it is perhaps in some ways the most worrying. The National Security Advisor to the President, of course, is the right-hand man for the President, in this case, a Lieutenant General of the United States Army, who has seemingly been rather directly insubordinate to the President on a number of issues and substantively very much at odds with him on a host of policies. Talk a little bit about your findings in those regards.
Well, we looked at sort of three policies, positions on the Iran deal, Israel, and Islamist terrorism, and focused on that. I believe some other people have looked at McMaster's positions on some other policies that may differ from President Trump's. And we are very fortunate that we have a president who has good policies in the three areas that I mentioned. He's opposed to the Iran deal. He's often spoke about tearing it up. He often spoke about the problems with Islamist terror, including in his inauguration speech. Apparently, according to a number of sources, McMaster asked President Trump to remove the word Islamist terror from his speech, from the president's speech in Warsaw. President Trump also has good policies on Israel. Something that concerned me that way before we put out this report, there was a press conference, a White House press conference, shortly before the President Trump left for Israel for his first trip to Israel. McMaster spoke at the press conference together with Sean Spicer and said that President Trump will be announcing that he's in favor of Palestinian self-determination during the trip, which is code for a Palestinian Arab terrorist state, which would become an Iran proxy. This has not been President Trump's policy, and we were actually pretty shocked at that statement.
It was shocking. And the more so because, as you say, in this instance, as with radical Islamic terrorism, as with the joint document such as it is about the Iran-Obama bomb deal, I call it, what McMaster has been doing in each of these areas, certifying that the Iranians are in compliance and that this deal is in our interest, for example, and objecting to the president's language and and really making pronouncements about a profound course change by the president. Now, in the event, he didn't actually endorse Palestinian self-determination, as I recall, and he did continue to use radical Islamic terrorism, and he has, in fact, said he doesn't like this JCPOA, even though he has certified it a couple of times. But what does this say about what's going on between McMaster and his agenda and that of the president?
Well, it's obviously concerning. It's, you know, very concerning when McMaster says that President Trump is going to announce something that's a complete change in policy, which was very concerning. By the way, ZOA also put out a press release at that time, which you'll find on our website, I believe, through the same search, where we talked about that and said, well, we hope that that's not going to happen, that the president is not going to call for this. And in fact, the president did not call for it during the trip or at a later point.
He did, however, go to what McMaster, I'm told, and I think your report documents this, he called occupied territory, the Western Wall in Jerusalem, one of the holiest sites for Jews in the world, and certainly very much part of the territory that Israel now controls after the Six-Day War. Again, the question is, what is he about? And would you just, we're going to run out of time before we run out of things to talk about with you, Liz Burney of the Zionist Organization of America, but just talk a little bit about two other aspects of what McMaster has been doing that you document in the report, both with respect to firing or purging people who are loyal to President Trump's policy agenda, on the one hand, from the National Security Council staff, and hiring people who seemingly are very much not.
As you mentioned, McMaster has fired, or people have moved on to other positions, several people, you know, quite a number of people who have wonderful positions and have done wonderful work in the areas that we've you know, that are of particular concern to the ZOA, the Zionist Organization of America, including K.T. McFarland. I've always been a big fan of hers. She was a staunch Iran deal opponent. She is a staunch Iran deal opponent. She's an opponent of global Islamist terrorism, and, you know, has written about that at length. You know, strong supporter of Israel, Ezra Cohen-Watnick. I won't go through all of them because people can read about it on the website. But he's also appointed some people who are of concern. One of them is this Chris Bauman. The ZOA, the ZOA also did another piece on Chris Bauman, who was one of McMaster's appointees, and we went through his thesis, and he has a whole plan to basically try to force Israel to withdraw to these indefensible lines, the 1949 armistice lines, which some people refer to as 67 lines.
Oh, they're called the suicide lines, including, I think, your colleague Mort Klein. And just to calibrate this, this individual, Chris Bauman, has been made the National Security Council advisor on the Israel-Palestinian issues. I mean, this is really a profound, you know, slap in the face, it seems to me, of the kind of agenda that the president has laid out for Israel. Again, it's not an isolated incident. It's true with a number of others, including Dina Habib Powell. Talk a little bit about her, if you would.
Well, she was the replacement for K.T. McFarland. She had no, she's Egyptian-born. She had no experience in national security versus K.T. McFarland, who's very experienced and wonderful in national security. She has strong relationships with a number of problematic Democrats, such as Valerie Jarrett. She's been called Huma Abedin's Republican doppelganger. She's defended Abedin. Journalist Daniel Greenfield, who has also been writing about this, said that Habib Powell attended a dinner for members of the Muslim Brotherhood front group. So there's a lot that's very concerning there.
The main point of all of this, I guess, and I think your report comes down squarely on the side that this individual, Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, ought to be given other duties rather than the National Security Advisor to the President of the United States. I couldn't agree with you more on that, Liz Birney, and I want to thank you and the Zionist Organization of America for your courage in speaking out about this, for helping to document why that's so, and for your leadership more generally on a sensible policy approach towards the Middle East in general and towards Israel in particular. Keep it up. I know you all will. My best regards to your boss, Mort Klein, as well. Thank you for taking time to join us today. Next up, we'll speak with Mark Krikorian about the Trump immigration agenda and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's a pleasure to say we're joined by Mark Krikorian, the executive director of an organization that is simply indispensable, as far as I'm concerned, in the nation's capital when it comes to matters involving our borders and the internal enforcement of our laws with respect to immigration. It is, of course, the Center for Immigration Studies. It makes an outsized contribution to our understanding of the challenges we're facing in these regards, and the importance of the efforts that Donald Trump is making, or trying to make at least, with respect to course corrections. He is the author, among other things, of the new case against immigration, both legal and illegal, and also a very important historical book now, How Obama is Transforming America Through Immigration. The course that we were on before and that Donald Trump knows needs to be corrected. Mark Krikorian, so good to have you with us. Welcome back, sir.
Well, glad to be here.
I'd like to start with something that was announced last week, I believe, with some fanfare, maybe 2 weeks ago now, between the president and two senators who are advocating a change in legal immigration with something called the RAISE Act. Would you talk about this Cotton-Perdue Act, its prospects, as well as your view of the necessity for adopting something along these lines?
Sure. This is a bill promoted by Senator Cotton from Arkansas and Senator Perdue from Georgia. And they had introduced earlier this year an earlier version of it. The White House said, you know, they liked it, they wanted some changes, and if so, if they made the changes, the president would really, you know, high profile the thing. And that's exactly what he did with an event at the White House. People introduce bills all the time. They don't get any attention. When the president shines a light on them, you end up forcing a debate. And this bill does three notable things. First, it gets rid of the visa lottery. We actually give 50,000 green cards at random to people around the world. It's the dumbest part of a dumb immigration system. The second part is that it changes, it focuses the definition of family visas just on husbands, wives, and little kids of American citizens and of legal immigrants. So it gets rid of the categories for other adult relatives that drive what's called chain migration. And then the third thing is that it streamlines the way we pick skilled immigrants. It leaves the number that we take the same, but it gets rid of the jumble of categories and red tape and uses what they call a point system, where you get points for different characteristics, education, English language ability, that sort of thing. And if you make the cut, you're then in the pool that they pick from for the, you know, for the green cards for that year. Overall, it's advertised as potentially cutting immigration up to a half, from 1 million a year down to 500,000. I don't think it would go quite that far down from looking at the specifics, but it would be a significant reversal in the, over the past 50 years of ever-growing immigration policy, most of it based on who you're related to and earlier immigrants who came in and bringing their relatives in.
Yeah. Let me ask you to drill down on a couple of points in what you just said, Mark Krikorian. One is that this will force a debate. I gather it's not clear that the majority leader is going to make the necessary steps possible to bring it to the floor. Is that the case? What are the prospects for this legislation, which seems eminently sensible?
Yeah, it's clearly an uphill climb because none of the Democrats will vote for it. Now, I say, you know, none of them will vote for it. Probably not, but, you know, we'll see. A bunch of the Republicans, the usual gang of eight suspects, have said they don't like it either. The first step, though, is to get committee hearings on it. And that is entirely possible. Senator Grassley didn't sign on as a co-sponsor, but I think he's, you know, at least a fellow traveler, if you will, on this bill. So if it gets hearings, that right there, you know, makes it more of a real thing than most of the bills that are just introduced for show. And the other thing that I think can increase its prospects, even in the Senate, is when the companion bill is introduced in the House. So, yes, it's an uphill climb, but you have to start somewhere.
And it deserves our support is the point. Lastly on this, I do wonder, Mark Krikorian, you described a sensible definition of families in this bill. Of course, we've recently had the spectacle of a judge out in Hawaii, as I recall, saying, well, no, the president, in connection with his executive order recently and the Supreme Court ruling thereon, has defined too narrowly the family. They've extended it to, I think, grandparents and aunts and uncles as well. Would that bear on the ultimate disposition of this legislation, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I mean, if Congress can statutorily define who gets green cards or not, I mean, and that Hawaii judge's ruling is not going to be held up. I don't think it can stand up in the Supreme Court anyway. But yeah, judges don't get to decide who gets green cards or not. And moving away, and that's actually the biggest danger of these rulings about the travel ban. The travel ban itself will have relatively small impact, quite honestly. I mean, it's not the hill I would have chosen to die on for the administration. But the principle that judges can decide who gets to come into the United States is very dangerous.
Yeah, and it goes to a point that was sort of implicit in your discussion of the RAISE Act, is that people don't have a right to come here. They certainly seem to be, these judges, trying to give them one, and it's very dangerous indeed. Mark, in the remaining time, again, we're speaking with Mark Krikorian, the Executive Director of the Center for Immigration Studies. I did want to ask you about a piece that our mutual friend and colleague Daniel Horowitz wrote today, I believe at Conservative Review, about kind of backdoor amnesty that the president, despite campaign promises about DACA, seems nonetheless to be continuing this, what Daniel calls, unconstitutional program of the Obama administration. And he raises a very, very worrying correlation between that apparent amnesty, effective if not declared, and what is evidently a change in the trajectory of the numbers of illegal aliens coming across our southern border. What could you say about Daniel's piece, more generally, but specifically this possibility that we may now be watching under Trump levels of illegal immigration on a par with what we saw under the previous administration?
The arrests at the border are still way down from what they were before. They collapsed in January and February, when illegal immigrant arrests should have been going up. Every previous year, they went up a lot because Christmas was over and New Year's and all that, and people started coming back. They just dropped like a rock. And that was a real thing, and I think that's almost certainly a kind of wait-and-see response to Trump's election. What we've seen over the past 3 months now is a little bit of creeping back up. It's not just 1 month, it's not just 2 months. We've seen 3 months of increases now. And it's still below the previous year, there's no question about it. But what that suggests is that this so-called Trump effect, you know, where it sort of scared off illegals from coming, may be wearing off. And that was going to happen because when you initially have that kind of rhetorical effect to reduce illegal immigration, it has to be followed up by actual policies. And there's a lot that this administration is, in fact, doing. I mean, I don't want to sell them too short, but things like continuing this DACA amnesty. Another thing is the lack so far of worksite enforcement. I'm told by people I trust that it's coming, but it hasn't come yet. And that's an important way of sending message to prospective illegals that, you know, things really have changed. So my point here is that it looks like the initial Trump scare effect is wearing off. They need to continue to persist in putting place in policies that will make it stick and sustain over the longer term.
And then enforce those policies, of course. Mark Krikorian of the Center for Immigration Studies, thank you for the encouragement to do the right thing here and explaining what the downside risks of doing otherwise are. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.